Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, the 1st of September, 1999. We are in the Creekside Room of Koinonia this morning. Your presenter's name is Leo Eisminger, and his session number is 99-8, entitled Prison Restoration versus Retributive Justice. Let's listen in.
Understand how the church can escape applying those verses to their ministry. And then this verse from Psalm 103. The Lord is tender and compassionate, slow to anger, most loving. The Lord's indignation does not last forever, nor the resentments exist a short time only. The Lord God never treats us, never punishes us as our guilt and our sins deserve, using the Jerusalem Bible. I'd like to have you, Evelyn, there are two sheets back there on the table that I'd like to have you get. And this is the one, Changing Lenses. Changing Lenses. And it's from Howard Zaire's book entitled, with that title. And would you read with me the paragraph up at the top of the page? According to Howard Zaire, the assumptions which govern our response to wrongdoing are in fact out of step with the experience of crime, with our Christian roots, and even with much of our own history in the West. What is needed, Zaire contends, is a new lens to help us see beyond alternative punishments and even beyond alternatives to punishment. We now need to look for alternative ways of viewing and understanding both the problem and the solution. What if we use restorative lenses rather than retributive lenses? And then another book that I highly recommend is this one entitled Restoring Justice by Ness and Strong. And then you also have a sheet that has on it a comparison between restorative justice and retributive justice, and the outline or the discussion this morning will take a look at those. What Howard Zaire, who is a Mennonite, is asking us to do is to view crime differently, to view it not through the retributive lenses, which he contends is a process that fails to meet many of the needs of either victim or offender. And the present process that we are using to address crime in our country, for the most part, neglects victims while failing to meet its expressed goals of holding offenders accountable and deterring justice. And he says the reason for that failure are the assumptions we make about crime and justice. And what he feels is that we need to address the needs of both offender as well as victim. And what he's asking for us to consider is an alternative vision, which he calls restorative justice. And what he wants us to do is to be able to identify what crime means and normally ought to happen when it does happen. And today we're not going to look at, when we think of restorative justice, we will not preoccupy ourselves whether this vision can encompass all situations. Someone is sure to raise the question, well, if we use restorative justice, what can you do with someone like Charles Manson? Well, we aren't going to preoccupy ourselves with that. But what we want to do today is, first of all, to look at crime the way the Bible understands it. And the way the Bible understands crime, as I see it, is an injury and a violation of people, of relationships within the community. Justice ought to focus on repairing or making things right. And if you'll notice here on retributive justice, the first one. Crime is an act against the state, a violation of a law that the state has set up. In contrast to that, going along with a lot of the things that you've been saying, Ron, in your lectures, crime is an act against another person or the community. Community here is what is important. And crime involves injuries which need healing, according to both the authors of this book and Howard Zaehr. The four victims, first of all, it's the victim. To the interpersonal relationship between the victim and the offender. Third, there's injury also to the offender, and then fourth, to the community. Now, retributive justice defines the state, not the community, not persons, but the state as the victim. Wrongful behavior or criminal behavior is a violation of the rules of the state. And most often, as we view crime in our country, we see it, we do not see the relationship between the offender and the victim as being relevant. And tomorrow, if you'd like to see this restorative justice in motion, I would invite you to come, because tomorrow we are going to be viewing two videos that show restorative justice working. I'm not going to say that it always works, but we have those two demonstrations tomorrow. What we're going to say here, that secondly, if you go down the list, crime control lies primarily in the community. Crime is a violation of people and of relationships. Now, all crime involves people and relationships, even property crimes. Any of you a victim of property crimes? Okay, how did you feel?
I realized that it was a child who must have gone in through a window and then be aided by an adult. It was not a big thing. I lost a VCR and a telephone. But it really moved me to prayer for that child and the adult who had put him up to that.
Did you feel violated?
Yeah, sort of, but I was very fortunate because they poked around, but they didn't really mess up anything. But, yeah, but it is, you know, I thought, well, it's pretty secure. But
how did you feel?
Yeah, I felt violated. I got a call. It was like I was going to work that morning. I live in a condominium. And then I got a call about a quart of salmon. Nobody calls me a quart of salmon. It was the Ramsey County Sheriff, and they said they asked me who I was, and they said, "Well, you need to come downstairs because we have break-ins in cars." And they asked me what my car was before I even came down. They said, "Yeah, your car has been broken into." So what happened was somebody, the garage door, we have electric garage door opener, and apparently the cycle was too long. Long enough for a person to come in, and what they did, they broke my window, but they didn't take anything, and they only took they took stereos, aftermarket stereos, because mine was factory, mine was in the dash where they couldn't just take a screwdriver and just take it out right away quickly, but yeah, I felt violated, so I never. That never happened again, from what I know, because I've lived there for well over 10 years now. So.
The crime affects our sense of trust, resulting in feelings of suspicion, of resentment, sometimes even of racism. And I blush to tell you this story of my experience of being distrustful, suspicious, feelings of estrangement and racism. I'm from the Midwest, and we hear all these kind of horror stories about what happens in and around Los Angeles and so on. My daughter, in California was marrying a native of California, and they were going to have a wedding at a school, was it?
It was the chapel of a school.
Chapel of a college, okay? But security was so tight there that they had at the entrance to the college a gate. You couldn't get in unless you had made prior arrangements, or the person at the gate knew that we were coming and so on. Well, we were waiting for the wedding to start, and here came the most dilapidated rattletrap of a station wagon that you can imagine. It was backfiring, it was smoking, there was no muffler, and it went around to the edge of the parking lot and stopped. And four guys got out who were obviously from south of the border, and dressed very shabbily. One had a huge tummy, and his t-shirt, as I recall, only covered about this part of it. And there they stood, wraparound sunglasses. And boy, I thought, what in the world are these guys doing? And others were concerned. We have my wife has a brother-in-law from San Diego, and he went around warning the women, grab up your purses. And I was kind of caught up in all of that too. And I was wondering, how in the world did they get past the security gate? So I went down to the security gate, there was nobody there. And we're busy looking around for the telephone or something so we could call some authorities at the school or something. And there was rumblings throughout the family that, you know, here we have all of the wedding gifts exposed in our cars, ready to take to the reception. And so we were making arrangements for somebody within the family to miss the wedding and patrol the parking lot. And I just thought, well, I'm going to talk to these guys. And I went up there, and they said, yes, we have a right to be here. We are the janitors of this place. Is there something we can do to be helpful to you? And they were the nicest guys. Absolutely, so helpful. They helped me find the PA system. We had it was a tremendously hot day. They found fans, and they lighted, there was a huge chandelier of candles, just a beautiful thing. They let that down, lighted all of the most helpful people in all the world. But, you know, that's what crime does, affects our sense of trust, resulting in feelings of suspicion, of estrangement, sometimes of racism. And I'm ashamed to share that story with you, because it gives an indication of where I was at that time.
I thought they were going to be the musicians.
I thought they were going to be in the wedding party.
But crime does frequently create walls between friends and loved ones and relatives and neighbors. In our WAIT support group, WAIT, that we have, it means we are inmates too, for adult family members of inmates. Very often, a wife will come, or a special person to the inmate, and to tell us that her family is telling her to cut off all relationships with this guy. And he is, after all, the mother of my children, she'll say. And yes, I still love him, but my family asks me, why should I continue loving him? So it does do things like that. But crime represents a ruptured relationship. And if there wasn't a relationship before the crime creates one. And that relationship is usually hostile, left unresolved. The hostility will affect the well-being of both victim and offender. And one of the videos that I'll show tomorrow will demonstrate how the hatred and the resentment of the victim was something that she carried with her for years. And then through this process of restorative justice, she said, it was as though 100 pounds were lifted off my back. And I hope that if you take only one thing with you from this session today, it will be this, that crime is not first an offense against society, much less an offense against the state. Crime is an offense against people. And the Bible holds out for us a vision of how people ought to live together in a state of shalom, of right relationships, and behaviors that we, for the time being now, will call crime, violate such relationships, but so do a host of other harms, including acts of injustice and oppression by the powerful against the powerless. And to be biblical in our understanding, I think we have to view injustice holistically, without artificial lines between crime and other injustices. The First Testament prophets remind us that structural injustice is also sin, and that kind of injustice simply breeds more injustice. I'll never forget the day when my blinders came off. It was when I was way into my ministry already, but we had a speaker in church one Sunday talk about systemic racism. And up to that point, I had always defined racism as existing only in persons. I didn't see how racism was embedded in many of our institutions. And when those blinders came off and I saw how innocently I was participating in some of that systemic racism, it eventually led me to add my voice to those who were protesting our ELCA pension office for investing in South African companies that practice apartheid. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were involved in that or not, but do you remember some of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of hard feelings. Boy.
Yeah? And but we
There were people who said the church shouldn't get involved in that. There were people who said the church shouldn't get involved in that. That was political.
Yeah. Oh, we ran up to against some tremendous resistance from church leaders for that. But the goal for this particular model of dealing with crime is restoration. And so if crime is injury, what is justice? Now, when today, when a crime is committed, what are the questions that are asked? What questions do we deal with? What's the first thing we want to find out?
Who did it?
Who did it? Okay. Now that we found out who did it, then what?
Then they need to be brought to charges against them, and then they don't have an attorney, they can get an attorney. And
so the question right off the bat, who did it? Then when we find out, what should be done to the offender? And then what does the offender deserve? Instead, when we ask the biblical question, the question we ask is what can be done to make things right? Justice is not retribution, but it's restoration. Restore that person. Justice will repair injuries and promote healing. Now, we can't guarantee full recovery, but the first goal ought to be restitution and dealing and healing of victims. And tomorrow you'll see another example of this, but I'll give you an example. In Preshow, South Dakota, we have an ELCA congregation, and 4 years ago, two children of migrant workers did over $15,000 of random vandalism to that church. Somehow they got in, destroyed stained glass windows. It was just really a mess. And the Sunday that I was asked to conduct worship there, a part of the fellowship hall was cordoned off, and there were sheets of plywood over where stained glass windows used to be. Not only was the congregation, but the whole community was in an uproar. Anger within that congregation was at a tremendously high level. And I'm sure if the parents could have, at that particular time, they would have packed up and left town. The council president is a personal friend of mine. And we set the process of restorative justice into motion. And a mediator who shares the same office building with me was sent to pressure. The first meeting she had was with the victim, the congregation. And she listened to the outpouring of anger and resentment and the desire for retaliation. She met then secondly with the offenders and their parents. And she also met with the prosecuting attorney of that county. While we focused on healing, the process then went something like this. The two boys, 12 years old, agreed to work off the deductible of the insurance coverage. That was, I think, several thousand dollars. And they were to also be available to do work for church members. And so for some of the elderly folks in town, they mowed their lawns, they did their gardening, they put up storm windows, they helped on ranches, they shoveled the walks. Before the one boy finished his obligation, he and his parents moved out of town. But the other boy sort of became the son of the congregation. And he had come up to the church and helped the older women cut out quilt blocks on their days of quilting. And then he also helped decorate the church for Christmas, did all kinds of things. The pastor told me that this boy would often hang around the office and ask for things to do. At the Sunday school Christmas program, the president of the welcome group called this boy to the front of the congregation during the program. And then there were some of the other officers of the welcome group, and they brought out one of these quilts that they had made, and together, as this young boy stood there, wrapped the quilt around him. The congregation stood and applauded. Now, I know that this congregation will never forget the vandalism, but there was a sense of recovery and a sense of closure. And I often think of what might have happened if we'd used the retributive model. Just kind of think about that out loud. What do you think might have happened?
Their anger would have kept on. I mean, it wouldn't have been able to work through it.
And the boys would have entered the institutional system, and who knows what that would have perpetuated in their lives.
A ripple effect in these guys' lives.
Yeah.
And if you've ever been a part of a rural community, you know that these rural people do not forget. They hang on to some of that stuff for years. Reconciliation implies repentance and forgiveness. It involves establishing a positive relationship between offender and victim. Now, I know it's unrealistic to expect a reconciliation in all cases. But, yes?
Can I mention another case there? And I don't remember, this last Christmas, the Christmas before, somebody drove in Sioux Falls, drove across someone's lawn, and broke their lawn or Christmas lawn ornaments and did other damage. The family, they were able to track down who it was because of the car tracks and all this kind of stuff. The family, instead of saying, okay, we're going to press charges against this kid who was 17 or whatever it was, said, he's going to come to our home, he's going to help us redecorate, he's going to help us make new lawn ornaments that he wrecked. And then it was his reaction, you know, I mean, here, it turned him around. I'll never do anything like this again because I saw what it did to this family. And working with them, he felt their forgiveness, and it made him, for that young man too, entirely different.
And just to add to that, I mean, you know, it's one issue is the state, but the other issue is lawyers. I mean, if lawyers enter that scene, what they will say is you don't want the offender in any way, shape, or form communicating with the victim. Mm-hmm. I mean, immediately when the lawyer steps into the situation, it's like, don't even create the environment for that to happen.
Right. Yeah, our system is directly geared towards that. You don't want that kind of process to take place.
No, no.
Yes.
The thing we read about recently, and was it in Minnesota or someplace, where the woman who had committed the crime with one of these groups, you know, in the 60s, now living a useful, productive life with her family, married to a doctor, and so on and so forth, and finally, she's been restored, but then the state says you have to pay.
They want their pound of flesh.
Yeah.
It's a crime against the state, not against the community. And so we ask different questions. In restorative justice, we ask the question, who has been harmed? In retributive justice, we ask, who did it? What should be done to them? And retribution often leaves a legacy of hatred that is never healed. In Sioux Falls, on death row now, is a man by the name of Donald Mueller. He is accused and was tried and found guilty, and I guess there, in my judgment, there's real questions about that, but they have to find some offender. But anyway, he's accused and found guilty and sentenced to death for the murder of a 9-year-old girl. This happened 5 years ago, and the mother and the girl's father,
stepfather,
had moved to New York. And but she is pressing the state now for the opportunity to be the one that pushes the plunger of the lethal injection when Donald Mueller dies. Mm. Think of what she is carrying around with her.
And she's carrying a lot of anger. I guess what I'm wondering is, it sounds like this restorative justice, what you talked about so far, works pretty well with property crimes, but how does it work with, how would it work with a murder?
Yeah. Well, tomorrow we will see that, if you want to.
I don't know, it was like 2020 or when one of those, that type of program. They talked about this woman who's, I can't even remember now what, if like a sister or somebody had been killed. She fought for the death penalty, not, I mean, this guy was supposed to get put to death. And she fought and fought against that. And it told her all she went through because the state, you know, state prosecuting attorneys, everyone was giving her such a hard time because they didn't want her to do that. But she got enough people with her that when it went to trial again, but she found it so difficult, and it just made her so upset that it was against her and her family, and yet the powers be didn't want, they didn't want any kind of, want her to interfere. They wanted to put him to death, mm-hmm. and not let her say, you know, this isn't what I want as a family.
Now, last week when I gave a lecture on the death penalty, I distributed a legal document that people can fill in and sign that asks the powers that be, if my life is taken in a violent way, I do not want the person who did this to die, to be executed. So.
Would that have any legal standing?
Yes.
It would? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know, you know, you raise an important question. Forgiveness cannot be forced, and probably in some cases forgiveness is impossible. But we hold it up as an ideal.
Mm-hmm. In the movie Dead Man Walking, one of those families is able to be forgiving in a way, and the other one is not, of the two young people who were killed. If you remember that, if you both saw the movie. Mm-hmm. And the ones that were able to say, yeah, we can forgive them, they came back. I mean, they were able to be
released
of a lot of things that the other family couldn't because of their continued hatred and wanting.
And the forgiveness doesn't necessarily rid a person of the pain.
Oh, no.
Of the experience.
Mm-hmm. But it lessens it in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, some people say, the only way that I can get any satisfaction is that I see that person put to death. But that person does not, according to studies, does
that
not...
That doesn't really bring satisfaction to those people either. In the long
So they followed up on the people that, the victims after a execution, how are they doing?
Yeah, many of them who have not had this closure, this resolution, this talking... See, before, the state views crime as a crime against the state, a statute.
Right.
Restorative justice views crime as something that people has, what someone has done to another person. And so there's this face-to-face encounter. You're dealing with nothing abstract, but you're dealing with a person.
Mm-hmm. And they have done studies about people who have been able to forgive,
right,
and those who have not.
Uh-huh.
And then
we have some cheap ideas about forgiveness. I think, generally speaking, people say, "Well, forgive and forget." Well, you don't.
No.
Forget. The pain, as you say, remains. I think Henry Nouwen, in one of his books, says the scars we bear give evidence to wounds that have been healed, but the wound was there. Mm-hmm. Well, just briefly, I want to, because there are Christians who quote the Bible in regards to retributive justice, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and they seem to base their idea on punishment as it is found in the Bible. I don't read punishment in the Bible that way. I see punishment in the Bible, yes, there is punishment, but the goal of punishment in the Bible is always to restore and to bring back. And one of the most helpful books to me has been Terence Fredheim's book. He's a professor at Luther Seminary, who has written a book, Creation, Fall, and Flood, in which he says that punishment, yes, but the goal is to restore. And when you picture God in the midst of the punishment, you picture God as biting his or her lip, wishing that there were some other way to bring his people back. It's just God's last resort, and it's the way used to wake people up, and the voice that you hear throughout the whole Babylonian experience is, come back, my people, come back to your lover, come back to your God. God gets angry, yes, but scripture seems to indicate that God moves through that anger, through that wrath, to restoration. And I'd like to hear your response to this, Ron, but wrath is not so much anger of God as it is when we say, talk about the wrath of God, is the consequences of our actions. That these are the things that are going to happen to us if we disobey. How you look at that?
Not so much an attribute of God as much as just an expression of the consequence.
Yes.
To see God as angry sort of diminishes the sovereignty of God, I think. I mean, in terms of a human, it's a human anthropomorphism of God, I think, attributing that human emotion to God.
On the other hand, if I consider anger to be a neutral feeling, yeah, and it's really what I do with the anger, then I don't mind understanding God also being having the right to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
But God always acts out of love, that guides that anger to again restore us, mm-hmm, rather than to punish us.
Yeah, the goal of punishment in the Bible is to restore. And Fraenheim makes a comment someplace, the ultimate fear would be for God to turn his back on us forever. But God will not do that. Go ahead.
In the very secular movie, The Prince of Egypt,
mm-hmm,
I think it is interesting that the idea of Moses could yet weep over the Egyptians. I mean, I thought that was a pretty, somebody got in some good theology there. Yeah, they're God's people too, you know, these Egyptians drowned there.
In one of Elie Wiesel's book, he quotes some rabbi, mm-hmm, who comes up to Miriam and Aaron, mm-hmm, who after the dramatic walk across the Red Sea, they're dancing and saying the Lord has, you know, drowned their enemies. And the rabbi pictures God as screaming to Miriam, "What do you mean,
mm-hmm,
to dance when my people are drowning?"
Yeah, they're my people too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Howard Zierer says, depending on what lens we use, retributive justice or restorative justice, the world will look even a lot different, depending on which lens we use. We have today in place retributive justice, and it may not do what needs to be done, or even what its practitioners claim it does, but it works in the sense that we are experts in knowing how to carry it out. And so what is the church's role? How do we relate to a new vision of justice, to the justice system that is in place? And I think there have been several responses of what the church's role ought to be. The first response that the church has taken down through the ages has been one of withdrawal. I'll give you an example. Back in 1963, I accepted a call to a congregation in kind of the inner city of Chicago. And the bishop of the Illinois Synod at that time talked to me and he said, "Leroy, we know that this church is in the midst of a lot of change in the community." And it was. I mean, the whites were moving out to the fringes of the city, and the blacks were moving in, and it was a changing community. And he said, "Now, I want you to understand, Roy, that the church's business is to save souls, not to get involved in social issues."
I can remember one day when Leroy was at the pastoral, I don't know, their pastoral get-together, you know, if they have, wasn't a big convention, it was just your. And he didn't come home, and I thought, what in the world is going on? Has something happened to him? When he got home, he said, the topic that day was, how welcoming are our churches? And some of these pastors saying, well, sure, you know, we'll let the blacks and we're going to come. And the big argument was, yes, but if they come, how are they going to feel? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Oh.
One pastor got up and said, the blacks can come into our church, but we will not welcome them. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
What year was that?
This was 1963.
Okay.
Yeah, we were there until 68.
The antecedent church. What was the antecedent church?
It was the ALC.
Okay. Now, the ALC in the early 70s had a high-level commission on the church's vision for the third century of American life. And that set guidelines for program and policy. I was privileged to be a member of that commission. And that made a very clear statement that the church could not separate itself from the political scene, that it must be involved and work with anybody else who was involved in that. The one dissenting vote on that was Al Quie, governor of Minnesota, former, because he felt it needed to be an individual thing. But that was adopted as official church policy in the, I mean, it went to convention and it flew. I mean, we had, well, Al Rognes was chair of the of that commission, and Governor Link of North Dakota, Martin Szabo, representative, and you know, it was a privilege to be on that. But that was a very clear statement: we must be involved.
But
not everybody bought it. Disappoint, but it passed the convention. Yeah.
I think the rhetoric has changed, but the from the perspective of the church general. But the mission hasn't. Today it's not to save souls, we kind of move to get away from that individualized, but it's to grow the church and go after the unchurched to get them in our membership. And that I hear as the emphasis, the mission emphasis of the national church today. If you happen to be involved in your community, great, but your primary purpose and focus is to get those people who are on church into your church.
I think it's happening. We still use the rite of affirmation of baptism, which we used to call confirmation. And there's that statement where the confirmant is, do you pledge to work for truth and justice? No, peace and justice in all the world. How can you work for justice and peace if you don't get involved? But we're still using that right. So, you know, yes, I hear you. I mean,
but
it's still
withdrawal, and we could give example after example of how that has been the church's response in a variety of different times. There was another response instituted when Constantine came into power, and that was recapitulation, where the church adopted the assumptions of the secular world, where the church's people see no difference between what the state is saying and what they are saying. Yesterday, in my lecture, I gave an example of in our neighborhood, not too far from where we live, a ELCA pastor feigned cancer for several years in his parish. And he would disappear occasionally, leaving the people up in the air, but he was away at some medical center, quotes, getting some experimental cancer treatment. And there were a couple Saturday nights when he would call me because I had my worship on Thursday, leaving Sunday's special offerings. They had matching funds from Lutheran Brotherhood events. The conference youth gave their convention offering to him, some $40,000 in all. when it was revealed that he didn't have cancer at all. And it was interesting that during the trial, the judge did not sentence this man to prison, but gave him 5 years of probation and asked him to return the money. But the letters to the editor of the paper, the most vehement ones, this man, we didn't get justice. We demand justice. Why didn't he go into prison? Those letters came from members of that congregation. Yeah.
How do you define justice?
Let's take a look at Christ's strategy, which I feel is the one that we are asked to be involved in, which asks us to create the new in the midst of the old, to create a new society within the society of which we are a part. And so he talks about the leaven, which leavens the whole loaf, the salt, which flavors the whole. And I hear Christ calling us to form a new society with new principles and assumptions and operating in the midst of the old, and to also serve them as a challenge to the old world, to the old way of looking things. And too often, the church has responded to the wrongdoing with retributive lenses borrowed from the larger society. Now, this whole thing of retributive versus restorative justice, this restorative justice may sound impossibly visionary and unrealistic. And I told the people yesterday my experience with meeting with some members of the South Dakota legislature about a different way of handling inmates who were on work release and who were trustees. And after I made my presentation, the chairman of the Appropriation Committee said, Leroy N. Peer, you know, that's where our capital is, pastors are considered naive, they're considered do-gooders, and they have no credibility. Well, maybe all of this is tremendously naive in our kind of society, but yet, once the voices of those who are calling for the abolition of slavery sounded this way, naive, it cannot be done. But I hope that you've gained an idea that this is something to aim at. Idea that will point a direction that I believe our Lord took as he looked at Isaiah. And it takes courage to do something like this, but I think often of the preface of Copernicus's book. His book, as you remember, revolutionized the way society thinks about the cosmos. But it took a whole century before people took Copernicus seriously. And they didn't take him seriously because his book at the time went counter to the common sense of his time. And the man who wrote the preface to Copernicus's book said this: "This is a book that deserves to be read. But remember, it is just an idea. It is a model and a vision. It is not necessarily reality." Well, maybe restorative justice is a vision like that, that is a indistinct vision of a long, long road that we have to walk before it comes into reality. But I think of Jesus, who said that our goal is to set at liberty those who are oppressed, proclaim liberty to captives, to bring out prisoners from their dungeons, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. It's going to be a long time, I suspect, before that reality will be a part, but I hope that we can move in that direction. I'll stop there and we can ask some questions.
With your last reference to the passage, and going back to how the church has avoided this kind of issue, you know, it's clear to me too, but I think historically the church has spiritualized, particularly Luke chapter 4, verse 18. So the captives are those who are captive to their own sinfulness or blind to the truth, you know, oppressed by demons, has nothing to do with relationship as you and I think of relationship within a community. And so simply by spiritualizing that verse, we have, the church has also then spiritualized Jesus' agenda and taken it out of the realm of the world in which we live.
And let's be honest, we have some hymns that feed into that.
Oh, you bet that we do, yeah.
This world is not my home. Mm-hmm. I'm just a passing through.
Well, the hymn I grew up on was, I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home. Let's get through this.
For change and decay all around I see.
Yeah. Mark, you bet.
I think it's in a different category, but I think the Amnesty International, which has made a difference, and for the lives of political prisoners and keeps working at it. I've been a member now about 10 years. Illustrates that if people get stirred up enough and have information enough, that could be a comparable, you know, movement to, hey, now look at some of the people who are simply prisoners of a rigid legal system. I think there's a model which is, I mean, that's a movement, at least that's helpful. Although it's not the kind of, you know, criminal justice kind of thing, but.
But in our prison system, I hear so many of the men in the prison talk about the fact that they wouldn't have minded so much if the goal of the prosecuting attorney was to prove guilt or innocence, mm-hmm. but it was to win, mm-hmm. and win at all costs. And I suppose, you know, the example in California was probably an example of this.
And that's supposed to be what the prosecuting attorney does, right? Prove the guilt or innocence of the...
Prove the guilt of
the defendant?
Yes.
Or prove the guilt, yeah.
Yeah, prove the guilt.
Right.
What's so frustrating to me is getting to know these men in prison is that the man who did the crime and was sentenced 20 years ago, is not the same man that's in prison now. He's had a complete change in his life. He came in and he was a teenager who didn't care, you know, he didn't listen to anyone, and he committed this crime. Now he's a man who has, he's been in the prison system, has come to find that Christ loves him, and he is a human being, he's a person of worth, and I would love to be on the outside and be able to work with other kids, keep them away from this place, but here I am. I committed that crime. I came in here at 19, and I'm going to be here as long as I live because my state gave me this life without parole, and there's nothing I can do. And so no matter how much of an impact, how much they could do if they were allowed to be back out in society, they're not. I mean, they have to, whatever they can do within the prison, that's what they can do, helping others, but they can never be out there and be a citizen that's going to do something, because
in our state,
life without parole, that's it.
In our state, you cannot serve on a jury where there's been, where there is the possibility of a capital sentence being given if you do not believe in the death penalty. Mm-hmm.
With the trial this one guy, that was one of the things when trying to find the jury was, if you are against capital punishment, we won't use it.
Well, the, so it's back against you.
Yeah. Now, both the ALC and the LCA had statements, social statements, before considering the death penalty, and I know we used to have discussions and so on. I don't think the ELCA has, we're not going to do that many statements probably at this stage.
We have one, though, I think.
Do we have one on the death penalty?
We have the LCA statement.
I guess I missed
against
that.
Against the death penalty.
Okay, I thought we had that.
It was interesting, however. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time. I think it was the second or third Senate assembly that I went to after the formation of the ELCA, and put forth a resolution that we take a stand against capital punishment in our Senate, not necessarily nationally, but just in our Senate, taking responsibility for what happens in our Senate, since we touched on both Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. And the ELCA representative to our Senate body, after the resolution was put on the floor and the tabled because we ran out of time, went to the bishop and said that that resolution was out of order. Because the ELCA had not yet established a social policy statement regarding capital punishment.
Okay.
So, you bet I was waiting. As soon as they passed it, I resubmitted the resolution 2 years later. But, you know, I just thought, here's a situation where the national church, the larger church body, is not allowing the grassroots to really speak up and address matters of their own locale, let alone being a way of advocating for something that might happen nationally, simply by saying it was out of order. Because the hierarchy had not yet established policy.
This is kind of way out, but I remember when the whole issue of abortion came up, and there was a woman who said, okay, now who of the church, who are the ones deciding this in the church leaders? All men. And this woman said, you are talking about abortion, and it has so much to do with the woman, and you only have men that are discussing this and coming up with policy. And they're right.
Well, we have talked today about restorative justice, I think is biblical. I think it's something that can work, because I have seen it work. Granted, it's only a minority of things, cases I've seen, but I hope that you'll give it a chance. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. You are?
Ron. Well, we'll be there.
Okay. Well, I can
There are some articles back there about my...